This is a CBC podcast.
Support for the delivery of this podcast is provided by Shoppers Drug Mart, celebrating Shoppers Optimum's 10th birthday.
It's Shoppers Optimum's 10th birthday, and you're all invited. Join the party in-store now until September 3rd for new offers weekly. Sign up at shoppersdrugmart.ca for daily offers and savings, and enter for a chance to win 10 million Shoppers Optimum points.
Welcome to the podcast of CBC Radio's Dispatches for August 19th, 2010. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. This week, are we supposed to kill him or just burn down the house? A story of the lawless advance of development in the Amazon rainforest. Mohammed's ghosts. A new book says Muslims and their mosques are fading from the American landscape. Inside North Korea, why the South helps defectors tell their stories of hunger and horror. And summoning the dead to protect the living. It's a Jamaican tradition that disturbs some in the Christian community. So why is the country promoting it? This is Dispatches. And welcome to an encore edition of Dispatches in the Summer. On a spring day 6 years ago, Mohammed Gharab was just the Islamic leader of a small mosque in a hard-scrabble neighborhood of Philadelphia. Next thing he knew, he was deported. His congregants were arrested without charge. The mosque collapsed. And it turns out there are thousands like him across the United States. Their biggest mistake seems to be that they're Muslim. In covering that story, it seemed to Stefan Salisbury of the Philadelphia Inquirer that ever since 9/11, the American justice and immigration system has been perverted. So he's written a book about it. Mohammed's Ghosts, an American story of love and fear in the homeland. Stefan Salisbury joined me from Philadelphia. Welcome to Dispatches.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on. I thank you.
What happened that spring morning in 2004 that changed Mohammed Gharab's life?
He was surrounded by police, federal law enforcement agents and immigration agents as he was dropping his daughter off to her school. She was a seventh grader. He was hustled out of his car into a federal police car and taken off to prison 3 hours outside of Philadelphia, where he was detained until he was deported about a year and a half later.
For what? What was the charge?
Well, it was an immigration charge, actually. He was a visa violator, according to the immigration authorities. At the same time that he was arrested in front of terrified school children, parents, and teachers, the mosque that he was the spiritual leader of, the Ansar Allah Islamic Society, was raided by 100 or so agents of the Joint Terrorism Task Force who entered the mosque with automatic weapons, bulletproof vests, and dogs, and ransacked the place, carting off computers, books, tape cassettes, papers, boxes. The imam's house next door was also raided and ransacked in the same way.
This wasn't about a visa violation. What was it that they suspected he'd been doing?
They almost immediately claimed this was not a terrorism investigation. They entered the mosque with a search warrant issued to the Internal Revenue Service looking for financial records of the mosque. However, in documents that I obtained from immigration court, federal agents were telling a different story. They said that the mosque was home for a secret terror training room where a airplane seat was located so that potential terrorists could be trained. They also said that that there were AK-47s located in the basement. These were statements that were made as fact. In subsequent hearings, no evidence of this ever turned up. It was never offered in court. At the time of this arrest, it was about a year after the onset of the Iraq War, we were in this country going through a period of intense scrutiny of all immigrants. And the imam who had spoken out against the invasion of Afghanistan and against very much against the Iraq War, like many others in this country, was someone who I would say the federal authorities saw right. He was ripe for the picking, and they plucked him.
Why should the rest of Americans worry about what happened to Mohammed Gharab? I mean, what in essence is your central thesis about the way the state wields power in America today?
What ultimately emerged from the situation that I was reporting on in this mosque was a extensive use of a network of informers and surveillance. It essentially poisoned the community of this mosque so that congregants were not able to trust each other. It spread into the community. The community did not trust the mosque. I mean, this is the essence of an informer-based society. It undermines the most basic fundamental element of community, which is trust. And community, after all, is the fundamental building block of the society. You're really undermining the very essence of democracy and open public civic life.
And do you see this culture of informancy bleeding into the general American society? It was focused originally, it seems, on those suspected of perhaps Taliban, Hamas links.
During the run-up to the Iraq War and thereafter, there were many, many, many instances of local police and federal agents infiltrating covertly anti-war groups, gay groups. I mean, any kind of civically involved organization was at risk, subject to surveillance of one kind or another. There was an instance I report on in the book out in Oakland when there was a large protest at the port of Oakland at the onset of the Iraq War. And police opened fire with rubber bullets or, I guess, wooden dowels, and several people were injured. And police had been alerted that trouble could be expected at this demonstration, which was simply an anti-war demonstration. It was not violent in any way, by a California-based surveillance center that was funded by money to conduct the war on terror. It turned out that police themselves had infiltrated the group and had gotten themselves elected to leadership positions so that they could direct the group to do what they thought the group ought to do. I mean, that's the danger here.
What could happen to Mohammed Gharib could happen to anybody?
I think that's absolutely true, and it has happened many, many times. We saw similar kinds of infiltration and during the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. We saw it during the anti-communist hysteria in the 1950s. It goes way back. There are deep roots in American culture, back to the Palmer Raids, which launched J. Edgar Hoover and his career.
Well, let me go back a little bit, because you've had an awareness, I dare say a wariness, of state power all your life. In a way most people never experience. Your father, Harrison Salisbury, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the New York Times' first Moscow correspondent, he had to live with it, and of course you lived with him. What do you remember about his experience with state surveillance, and what impressed it upon your mind back then?
This was before I was born, but our house in Mamaroneck, New York, was burglarized by the local police because a neighbor, an informant, had told them that my father was a German code expert working undercover for the United Press.
What do you think your father would make of the situation in America now?
Well, I think it would remind him, certainly within Middle Eastern communities, South Asian communities, of the kind of society that he encountered in the Soviet Union, or the kind of atmosphere he encountered when he covered the civil rights movement in Birmingham, Alabama in 1960, which was a city that was riven with fear, where phones were tapped and rooms were bugged and informers were everywhere.
What of your own experience with the state as a younger man? You were baited into a police trap in New York in the 60s, right? How did that color your view of the state power?
Well, I wasn't exactly baited. I was late for a demonstration that was at a draft center in New York City, and I struck up a conversation with a friendly young guy who was describing what I had missed because I was late, and he promptly arrested me and hustled me off to jail. He was an undercover cop. I also was a student at Columbia University during the late 1960s, the site of very well-known demonstrations and a strike. And the university was really riven with informers, both the student body and the faculty.
Yeah, people forget that.
A university is absolutely, utterly dependent on a free and open exchange of ideas. If you don't have that, the whole concept of a university is subverted.
You suggest that 9/11 and the security measures that followed have created a new kind of internal refugee in the United States. What do you mean by that?
This was particularly in response to an immigration program that was instituted about a year after the 9/11 attacks. It commonly is known as special registration, and it required immigrants from 24 primarily Muslim countries and North Korea to go through a very complicated process of registration. And there were over 80,000 people who registered under this program, and 13,000 were immediately put into deportation proceedings. So as a result of this and neighborhood sweeps, whole neighborhoods began to empty out. I saw it here in Philadelphia, where there was a small but significant and vibrant Pakistani and Bangladeshi community in South Philadelphia. It doesn't exist anymore because people were either themselves detained and deported or, seeing that happening, fled the community. Some I found in a suburban area outside of Philadelphia. Some I have no idea where they went. Brooklyn, home for probably the largest concentration of Pakistani Americans in the country, over 130,000 people. Saw half its population flee. So people who came to this country for opportunity and for the freedoms that it's based on were, in fact, returning back to places like Pakistan because of what was going on here in the mid-2000s. Now, it's interesting, and you're in Toronto. A lot of people from New York certainly went to Toronto, and I ran into a guy just last year. I was standing in a sweet shop on Coney Island Avenue in the Midwood section of Brooklyn, and this guy Muhammad was telling me that he had lived in Midwood, and he was just back there visiting, but he'd left and gone to Toronto. He says, "Toronto, who knows me? I know everyone in Toronto. The whole neighborhood that was here, it's now in Toronto." And I'd looked at what immigration figures I could find, and there was absolutely an uptick of Pakistani and Bangladeshi immigrants from the United States into Canada throughout 2003 and 2004, and perhaps even still going on.
Well, push that idea ahead, because your book is concerned that even as the rhetoric around the war on terror cools, damage has already been done to the American justice system. At one point, you write, "There, an absence of evidence is evidence itself." What are you driving at with that?
Whatever can be imagined becomes what is. And I spoke with a lot of law enforcement people in the course of doing this book, and you know, they're under enormous pressure. Once the policy was, you know, there cannot be another attack, then that translated on the ground to best to arrest first and sort it all out later. And that in many ways is what's still happening.
Where is Muhammad Ghorab now? Did he ever return to his mosque? What happened to him?
Well, he never returned to a mosque. He was held in jail, often in isolation, and then he was deported. He basically gave up his fight to stay in this country. He's now in Alexandria in Egypt, where he is has been unable to find work and has had to move in with his elderly mother. The Ansarallah Mosque ultimately was had to close, crushed by debt burdens and by the taint of a raid that had seemingly no purpose other than to intimidate. His wife, his American wife here, and their daughter, and her daughter by previous marriage, his stepdaughter, you know, they were financially crushed. The whole family was utterly destroyed, and is still very much feeling the effects several years later.
And how many like him are there out there as a consequence of the way the laws apply?
I think it's probably safe to say there are thousands, probably tens of thousands. Every Muslim family that has gone through this situation, really any immigrant family, if a man is picked up, in this case Imam Ghorab is picked up, deported, what happens to his American-born children? His stepdaughter was utterly humiliated. I mean, there was a raid in front of her school. Her schoolmates were calling her father a terrorist and a drug dealer. She was just destroyed by that. She's a 13-year-old girl. She refused to leave the country. She blamed her father, her stepfather, her mother, and ultimately she blamed Islam. That, of course, caused tremendous pressure for her mother, Miriam, who was torn between, does she follow her husband? Does she try to reconcile with her daughter? What does she do? It's a real, it's Miriam's choice. It's the choice that every immigrant has, who's been in this situation has probably been confronted with.
The book is a startling piece of reporting on the times that we live in. Thank you for talking to me about it.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
Stefan Salisbury is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the author of Mohammed's Ghosts, published by Nation Books. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada. The Dispatches podcast is available every Thursday. You can subscribe from cbc.ca/podcasting, where you'll find hundreds of hours of the CBC's best radio programs. Now, like you, Dispatches has heard about the global benefits of the Amazon rainforest, how it creates much of the world's oxygen, houses a vast array of rare wildlife, and supports vegetation full of medical secrets we've yet to unlock. We've also heard about the ongoing threats to its survival, the slash-and-burn development, and how it contributes to global warming. But we wanted to see for ourselves. CBC correspondent Connie Watson began her inquiry with a leisurely steam on the Amazon River, a kind of living slideshow revealing the perils of progress.
A man balancing a brand new refrigerator on his head makes his way along the congested boardwalk in the big commuter port of Manaus. No one even gives him a second look as he slides the fridge over the rails of a double-decker passenger vessel. Two other men pass by, shouldering a giant water tank, heading for another ship. There are hundreds of big boats tied up to the docks here, thousands of people swarming, selling, packing up, always moving. Manaus is the vital heart of the river's lifeline. It's also a manufacturing mecca and the biggest city in Brazil's jungle, where everything and everyone moves by boat, by water. I board the Prince of the Amazon, one of the boats casting off, to ride downstream for about an hour. Frequent traveler Silvio Camaleon is already settled into his hammock. Sandals kicked off, book on his belly, ready for his 20-hour voyage to Parintins. I really like traveling like this, he says. It's really, really, really good. Because it's not exhausting. I nap a little and meet other people on board. He pulls out the small guitar he's tucked into the netting above. It's a Bolivian charango. I'm a composer of folkloric music, he says, and the sights and scenery on this voyage really inspire me. Amidst the dozens of hammocks strung side by side from the ship's beams, Camaleon caught my eye because he's reading the same book I just bought, The Lost City of Zed. It's a true tale of life and death in the Amazon. Dispatches interviewed the author last year. It's about the British explorer in the early 1900s who perishes out there in the jungle, searching for a mythical city that no one has ever found. I asked Camaleon if it's as good as they say. Better, he tells me, a real page-turner, that he's in no hurry to finish. In fact, like the river, he's in no hurry, period. While the world's most famous jungle may have claimed its fair share of intrepid explorers, now it's the Amazon rainforest itself that's being swallowed up, devoured by development. The flat-deck ferry that's taking us across the river from Manaus goes under the towering steel skeleton of a huge bridge that will soon span the Rio Negro and make this hour-long ferry ride obsolete. Here on the other side, bulldozers and cats are already knocking down trees and packing the earth for brand new roads, preparing for sudden suburbia.
This is newly destroyed primary forest and newly built shacks. And
actually, Mario Cohn-Haft clicks through photos on his computer, evidence of illegal land grabbing and invasions close to Manaus, too close for comfort.
Our house, the house on the country place, was burned down last Friday, burned to the ground.
Cohn-Haft is the leading bird expert with the Brazilian National Institute for Amazonian Research. He and three colleagues bought a piece of old-growth rainforest a dozen years ago before roads, before electricity, and before thugs.
We had a caretaker staying there, a single young man, and he received a threat through a relative of his, said, hey, folks came by and they said, if you want to stay alive, you better move out of the house. He was a little nervous about things, and he heard voices. And he estimated four men approaching, and he heard them say, now, are we supposed to kill him or just burn down the house?
The caretaker ran for his life. The scientists ran to the authorities, who have so far done nothing. Kohnhaft says this is the way it works in the Amazon. Destroy the forest, wipe out what stands in the way, then develop the land. And this bridge is only the beginning.
It's one of a series of major development plans for the central Amazon. We're reassured that negative environmental impacts won't happen because times have changed and now we're in a time of governance. The problem is, in Manaus' backyard, in the largest city in the Amazon, 2 million people, we have a situation like this where a bridge indirectly leads to a land invasion and the burning down of private property. If that's going on within easy reach of police and the various powers that be, what are we to think is going to happen in the case of hydroelectric dams off in the middle of nowhere, paved roads cut through the middle of unbroken rainforest? Why should we believe that now it's going to be any different from what it's been all along the history of the development of the Amazon?
Brazilian authorities say proof that things will be different this time is right here, a few hours upriver from Manaus. We cut the boat's motor at the newest forest reserve in the state of Amazonas, set up just a few months ago. Families living here are known in Portuguese as caboclos, or river dwellers. They can stay, but they have to change their ways, their traditions. No more slash-and-burn agriculture, no more logging. In return, they get about $30 a month to preserve the jungle that surrounds them. Much of the money comes from developed countries, as part of a new scheme to reduce global warming by saving the rainforest. Pedro Gomes used to make his living cutting down trees. He's the community leader here in Bujaru, this picturesque little settlement of wooden cabins built on stilts right on the river's edge.
The poor communities around here don't starve because we get fish from the river and flour from the manioc we grow. But they almost starved when the ban on logging began and slash-and-burn agriculture in the forest was prohibited. Some communities went hungry.
Gomez says people are obeying the tough new law because they realize that preserving the rainforest is better than setting it on fire or cutting it down. Besides the money, they're also getting training in tourism and forest management. I ask him if the $30 a month plan can save this part of the Amazon, which is still mostly intact.
The river dwellers, we know the river system, the region, the forests. If it were just us, then yes, it could. But there are other people who live far away from here, who have money and influence, businessmen who keep working, keep destroying the forest.
You also have highways that are being built all over the place, and that is putting something in place that will bring on deforestation for decades to come.
Philip Fernside's been studying this rainforest for more than 30 years. The American scientist works at Brazil's National Institute for Research in the Amazon. He says paying small landowners like Gomes a bit of cash to preserve their local rainforest is a great idea, but says Brazil's own plans for expansion are fueling a far greater pressure on the jungle.
Right now we have a highway that is to connect Manaus here in the central Amazon with Rondônia, and this is something that would open up basically half of what's left of the Amazon forest to deforestation.
Besides highways, three dams are also planned, all part of Brazil's plans to keep up with its booming economy.
We're in what you call the heart of the Amazon. Is there a chance to still save this from the fate that's been arranged for many of the states around the outside edge of the Amazon that have been mostly deforested?
Yes, it's certainly very dangerous to be fatalistic about any of these things because it's very much in human hands what happens. The BR-319 highway is not yet approved by the Minister of the Environment, although there's tremendous pressure because the Minister of Transportation is the main force behind this highway. So to see what happens.
It will cost a lot more than $30 a month to pay off the big interests who want to mow down the jungle. But Brazil's officials say there is a precedent for roads in parkland. From Fernside's home country, the United States.
The most amazing thing is the environmental impact statement. And the example is given as Yellowstone National Park in the United States. But that's a completely different world from what it's like in the Amazon, where you have all of this chaos with these land grabbers and landless peasants and things happening outside of government control. And, of course, someday things might evolve to be like Yellowstone National Park, but by the time that happens, probably there won't be very many trees left.
But for many here, the road and the bridge mean progress, easier travel, more jobs, a new route out of poverty. Raimunda Ferreira has lived on the water most of her life. It's in her blood. She started this floating village 20 years ago. Now she's the leader of a community of 70 families just across from Manaus.
It's cheaper to live here out on the water. We can't afford to buy land. Sure, everybody dreams of a better life, but it's peaceful here.
I ask her if she's concerned that the new highway will destroy their traditions.
I don't think so, because authorities are being careful. They may destroy a small part of the forest, but it's not going to bring problems. It's going to be a big improvement for the people living nearby. I'm certain of that.
We stop our boat at the famous Meeting of the Waters, where the Rio Negro joins the Amazon.
Encontro das águas. Solimões e Rio Negro.
Sergio, our driver, points out the two distinct colors.
De início do Rio Amazonas.
At least a dozen pink dolphins bob around our boat, chasing all the fish congregated here. We pull up beside two boats floating idly. The guys seem friendly when they see us approach, flashing their wares, then hiding them when they see we're not paying customers. One man has a hold of an enormous black and brown boa constrictor. Another one has a small green crocodile on his lap. And a young boy has what looks like a baby sloth. Wrapped so tightly around his belly, the animal's head is completely hidden. Our guide says that sloth probably fell out of a tree that was logged, and that it likely won't live longer than a few more days. What these guys are doing is clearly illegal, but for them it's just another way to make a quick buck in a region that's a little like the Wild West. Sure, there are laws, but few people to enforce them. And this is small-scale theft of the Amazon's wealth of biodiversity, compared to what's expected when the roads, dams, and bridges are done. For Dispatches, I'm Connie Watson on the Rio Negro in the Amazon.
And Brazil, incidentally, is trying to crack down on animal poaching. Police recently arrested a British pet shop owner flying home with 1,000 tarantulas in his luggage. But a single egg from a blue macaw still fetches over $4,000 on Europe's black market. Know anything about that? We'd like to hear from you, or anything else you have to say about our program. Email dispatches@cbc.ca. I'll see about reading it on the program. Coming up on this encore edition of Dispatches, Jamaica's love-hate relationship with the spirits of the dead. But first, there have been times when dogs ate better than doctors in North Korea. American journalist Barbara Demick knows that because she met a pediatrician who found it out the hard way. Demick's a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spent 7 years documenting the dangers North Korea's unleashed upon the world, the nuclear threat, the famine, the prison camps. And thanks to her interviews with defectors, we have a better idea of what it's been like to live under the mercurial regimes of Kim Il-sung and now his son, Kim Jong-il. It's in her latest book, entitled Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Barbara Demick joined me from New York to talk about it. Barbara, welcome to Dispatches.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Nothing to envy is a common refrain, it seems, in North Korean propaganda. Why was it important enough for you to choose it as a title?
This song is one of the key pieces of North Korean propaganda, and the North Korean regime keeps itself going with the illusion that North Korea is the greatest country there is. We have nothing to envy in the world. And for the people that I'm writing about, at each stage of their lives, this song was very important.
It's a promise which is a lie that gets punctured. And I wonder if you could tell me how the story of the young Dr. Kim in your book, how her defection embodies the way the myth of North Korea's prowess was punctured.
She was literally starving to death, even though she was a doctor. She was receiving no salary and was living on handouts, cuttings of grass, and she swam through a half-frozen river, got out on the Chinese side, and came to a farmhouse, peered inside, and she saw a bowl of rice with a few scraps of meat sitting on the courtyard floor. And then at that moment, she had a realization that it was for a dog and that, in fact, dogs in China ate better than doctors in North Korea. And at that moment, she realized that all her illusions about North Korea were lies.
That's a remarkable story. The dog bowl has got more food in it than she's seen in days and days and days. In fact, famine is a very real memory for a generation of North Koreans still alive now. Hundreds of thousands perished in the 90s when the Cold War ends and North Korea's communist sponsorship collapses. I wonder, could you read for me that particularly poignant passage from your book about Mrs. Song? She's, what, a mother of four, soon to be three.
Soon to be three, that's right. Mrs. Song's son was a strong, fit young man, the spitting image of his father, but more athletic, more muscular, and at 5'9", taller. He needed a lot of fuel to survive. When at first his body fat disappeared, he looked as lean and taut as a marathon runner. But eventually the muscle, too, was consumed, turning him into a cadaver. In the cold winter of 97-98, when the temperatures dropped below freezing, he caught a bad cold that turned into pneumonia. Even with his weight loss, Nam Ok was too heavy for Mrs. Song to carry to the hospital. There were no ambulances working by now, so she went herself and explained his condition. A doctor wrote her a prescription for penicillin, but when she got to the market, she found it cost 50 won, the same price as a kilo of corn. She chose the corn. Nam Ok died in March 1998, alone in the shack. Mrs. Song was at the market again, scrounging for food. He was buried on a hill above town, next to his father's grave, close enough that it was visible from her home.
That's remarkable. Mrs. Song has to give up, in effect, part of her own humanity because of this famine. What about now? How difficult is food to come by now for the average North Korean?
It's still very difficult. I spoke to some people over the summer. These were people who had escaped into China in order to look for food. And what they described was not, you know, dead bodies in the street as there was in the 1990s, but a lot of people seriously malnourished, dying alone in their homes.
The people who flee this situation, they're going to a better life, but they leave behind families, and those families, well, you tell me, what happened to Moran's sisters, for example, after that character slipped out of North Korea?
North Korea punishes three generations of any family for the crimes of one. And when she and some members of her family defected from North Korea, unfortunately, they left behind two sisters, very loyal to the regime. That's why they didn't leave. In fact, they weren't even told. And those sisters were taken away to prison camp shortly after the family defected to South Korea. And that is the tragedy of many defectors.
You know, I noticed darkness is an ever-present metaphor in your book. The book even starts with that famous aerial shot of North and South Korea by night.
That's right.
Could you elaborate on that picture, on that metaphor for me?
Sure. It shows actually all of Northeast Asia by night and filled with light. And North Korea is a black hole because North Korea doesn't have money for electricity. They don't have fuel oil. I opened with this image because this black hole of North Korea you know, in fact, stands for what we know about North Korea. Very little. It's the only country in the world that is deliberately disconnected from the internet, cut off from the international telephone system, international mail. You know, they're a black hole in the world.
Your book puts faces, puts stories to situations and events we've heard about from North Korea. The labor camps, for example. You actually met a fellow named Kim who'd spent time in one, and I wonder, remind us what he described to you.
Kim Hyuk. Yes, he was put in a labor camp when he was just a teenager. What he described was really slow, deliberate starvation. He was given a little cup of beans and cornmeal once a day. He showed me the cup once. We were sitting in a Starbucks, and it was about half the size of a small Starbucks cup. Uh-huh. And that's all he had to eat. He was young and strong, and he survived, but many of the older men who were in the camp with him did not.
You know, it seems you reached a rare degree of intimacy with the defectors you interviewed. What was that like? I mean, your conversations with these people. I mean, what kind of behaviors did they display that hinted at the repressive backgrounds they'd escaped?
And they thought I was either a spy or a missionary. They didn't understand that there was, you know, a free press. A lot of them have digestive problems. Mrs. Song, the woman who I spoke about, I took her once to a French restaurant in Seoul. She wanted to try French food. And she was literally unable to, you know, consume her steak because she had never seen such a large portion of meat. Kim Hyuk, the boy who is in the labor camp, you know, is a real typical case because his growth was stunted by starvation at a young age.
He was a wandering swallow, right?
Yeah. The kochubi, this is a term North Koreans use for homeless children, the wandering swallows. He was starved from the time he was 6, 7, 8, and he's exceedingly short, maybe 5 feet tall. And, you know, his head is large for his body. When you're starved as a child, you know, your body wants to conserve the calories where they're most important. So the head will be a normal size, but the limbs are very short.
When you consider what it is that's enabled a small group at the top of North Korea to dominate everybody else, there's military power, of course, public executions you describe, and other forms of intimidation. But you also suggest something more insidious. You write that the strength of the regime came from its ability to isolate its citizens completely. And I wanted to know, how do you do that? How do you make everybody ignorant, unambitious, passive?
Well, televisions are fixed to the government station. Their radios are fixed to the government station. It's illegal to change your device to get any kind of outside broadcasting. There's no foreign newspapers. You're not allowed to receive a telephone call from abroad. You know, you're completely isolated. And therefore, they can perpetuate this lie. We have nothing to envy in the world. They believed that they didn't have enough food themselves because they were stockpiling food for their starving South Korean cousins. This can only be done in complete isolation. There's a hermetic seal around this country. And this is, I think, North Korea's essential problem right now. I mean, everybody always says, you know, why doesn't North Korea just, you know, open up like China? Look at China. They've kept the Communist Party while opening up their economy. But China, when they opened up, let in foreigners. North Korea does not want its people to meet foreigners. They don't want foreign ideas. They don't want books. They have to keep this lie going to keep themselves in business. So they're really stuck. That's why they keep the country so closed, and it's why they have not been able to reform.
Everyone's meant to revere the leader. It's dodgy to criticize him. And in the case of the man in your book called Chang Bo, what drew him to the state's attention, and what did it put him through for it?
He was watching the government news on television with some other people, and they had a report about galoshes. It was just a glowing report about a factory and how this factory was turning out thousands of galoshes for every man, woman, and child. And, you know, he kind of quipped himself, hey, if there's so many galoshes, how come my kids don't have any? Somebody in that room ratted him out, said, this man is not loyal he's criticized the regime. Now, he was able to get away with it only because he came from a very good, family background. An ordinary person might have been sent to prison camp.
If spying on your neighbor was once a national pastime, as you put it, is it still?
It still is. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you people are not only afraid to speak, they're afraid to think.
Talk to me then about the mentality of the North Koreans who make the decision to defect.
You know, one person in my book is completely amazed when she sees a rice cooker that has a sensor to tell when the rice is cooked. You know, she just thinks this is the height of modernity. They see they have something to envy.
They see nail clippers.
They see nail clippers.
And when the man saw the nail clippers, what was the realization that hit him with respect to the technological advances that they had and didn't have?
This guy was a soldier, and somehow one of his buddies got an American-made nail clipper, probably something you'd buy in, a dime store for a dollar. And his buddies were passing it around, and they were amazed at the technology, how cleanly their nails were clipped. It was, shiny and precise. And this young soldier saw it and realized, my God, if the Americans can make a nail clipper like this, think how good their bombs are. because they also thought that their technology was fantastic.
North Korea was built on external sponsorship from China, from the former Soviet Union. What funds it now? Who sponsors North Korea today?
That is a great question. They're not exactly living on air, but they're not living on much. There's some Chinese investment in North Korea in mining. They sell weapons to the Middle East, to Pakistan, Iran. They've been implicated in a lot of drug smuggling, amphetamines and heroin, currency counterfeiting. But they don't live very well. And, most of the country's resources go to the top leadership, to Kim Jong-il and his immediate family.
Plainly, China is an influence. And I'm wondering, how much is it in a position to actually affect North Korea's behavior? Or is there some strategic value to having a neighboring state that can plunge the West into a crisis at a moment's notice, especially over nuclear power, as it has done?
Well, on this one, I'm going to give the Chinese the benefit of the doubt. I think that China does have the power to make North Korea collapse. They seal the border. They could cause the collapse of the country. But I don't think they have the power to make it change. The Chinese have good reasons to worry about North Korea collapsing. A North Korean collapse could be very messy. You could have, warring generals. You could have loose nukes. You can have, refugees streaming across the border. And the Chinese are very worried about stability. And they, I think, prop up North Korea, I believe, for that reason. And the South Koreans—
Isn't that the same thing, though? Better to have this loose diplomatic cannon out there worrying the West than actually have its people flooding over our borders and causing problems for us?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know that they really approve of a nuclear North Korea, but I think they prefer a nuclear North Korea to a collapsing North Korea. And that's true of the South Koreans, too. I mean, right now there's a conservative government in Seoul, but under the past administrations, the South Koreans were very clearly propping up North Korea because they were afraid of what happened when it would collapse and they'd have all those hungry cousins, streaming across the border.
Mm-hmm. Well, on your most recent trip into North Korea, to Pyongyang and the capital, I gather you were wined, you were dined. The New York Philharmonic was there, no less. You had internet access. Was that evidence of true progress, do you think, or not?
No. I think it was evidence of what the North Koreans could do if they wanted to. It was black again the next night. The lights went out. They put on a great show when there's a big foreign delegation there, and then it's dark again.
So what are your thoughts about North Korea's future? Kim Jong-il is still in power and in poor health, if reports are to be believed. Does the prospect of regime change hint at any improvement in a lot of the citizenry, do you think?
I actually do think it could get much worse before it gets better.
Why do you say that?
When Kim Jong-il dies, because he doesn't have a clearly designated successor. there can be a scramble for power between the generals, and you could have a very unstable situation, you know, maybe some kind of civil war and anarchy. And, you know, eventually things should get better, but I think they could get worse before then. I think it could get very dangerous.
Remarkable story. Thank you for telling me about it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Barbara Demick is the author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, published by Random House, and she was in New York. It's estimated that more than 100,000 North Koreans have defected in this decade, and while June marks the 60th anniversary of the Korean War, technically it still isn't over, since the two sides only signed a truce, but never a peace treaty. And there's more pictures and audio from Barbara on our website, where you'll also find our podcast, cbc.ca/dispatches. Now, in the hills of Jamaica, you hear it. The sound of drumming, the worshippers of the dead, dancing and talking to the spirits in scenes as old as Africa. It's a practice that alarms some in the country's Christian community, though, but the state is all for it. All for keeping the concept of kumina alive, as we hear from British journalist Nick Davis among the drummers.
The beat of the drums resonates from high in the Jamaican hills overlooking Montego Bay. A couple of men are straddled over goatskin drums lying on the ground. Dancers pick up the beat and gyrate. Their necks and backs are bent back as they spin at an impossible angle. People from all over the community of Unity Hall have heard the call and are now gathering round.
The ancestors, whether black, white, you name it, they gather around.
Liebert Gordon's the leader of the group.
Who can see ancestors? As I said, some use it to bad, some use it to good.
This ritual is called kumina. Kumina plays and ceremonies call to the spirits of the dead at times of crisis or at funerals and weddings. Dead relatives are called to come and protect the living. Followers often go into a trance-like state called mayo, a form of possession allowing them to speak and travel and dance in the spirit. So what's it like when you're dancing?
Well, it is more comfortable and nice, and you know what I mean, to dance around.
Kumina is one of the only traditions that survived from the days of slavery. Africans preserved it by secretly practicing the religions of their homeland.
We're just walking down to the little store, which is actually built in around the rest of the community. There's a few houses around here and people to make a bit of extra money. Make little impromptu shop. And what do we need?
We need some rum and Pepsi.
Rum and Pepsi. Why do we need rum and Pepsi?
For the drums.
Yes. And keeps the drums...
mild and soft. Okay.
Wash the drum with the rum so the skin get tight.
Malem!
Dark in life.
Kumina was passed on by oral tradition from generation to generation. Families learned the religious ceremonies, the dances, the language and medicinal healing. Adherents of Kumina are mostly in St. Thomas on the island's east coast. It's an area with little European settlement and that's helped to keep the faith alive. But Liebert Gordon says their numbers have dwindled over the years.
Because some are afraid. Some people call it voodoo, science, you name it. In everything is two sides of story. We do it because it's an African type of culture.
Bernie, somebody to you here?
My grandmother didn't born in Jamaica. She was an African woman. We born in Nor. She lived ages.
Benicy Henry is the Kumina Queen of Port Morant. Her grandmother taught her the traditions of animal sacrifice and spirit possession.
I will never drop our African culture coming until Christ's resurrection morning.
She says that despite Kumina's followers mixing in European religious traditions with the African, they haven't allayed the suspicions of many churchgoers.
They said, afraid we use the rum. They're afraid we use the wine. We're using the wine. They're afraid of our sacrifice. God wants to test how much you say you love me. Give me your only one son. I always have sacrifice. Because so shall be the beginning.
Religion is at the core of Jamaican society. The nation is a melting pot of different races and faiths, from Hindu and Jewish to Muslim and Rastafari. Now, as I walk down this road in Kingston, I can spot at least three churches, and it's Christianity which has had the most opposition to Kumina.
As you walk into the Baptist Church in Ocharias on the island's north coast, one of the first things you'll spot, well, as you look up high above the pulpit, engraved into the stone is 1827, the year the congregation was founded. Now, the denomination played an instrumental role in pushing for the abolition of slavery, but they also wanted converts.
I want to remind us of our outreach open-air meeting this coming Sunday evening.
Reverend Jonathan Hemmings is the pastor and picks his words carefully in expressing his concerns about the African religious traditions.
Every culture, human culture, has elements that are useful but also elements that need to be redeemed by the gospel of Jesus Christ. European culture, African culture, they have elements that I think reflect something of the love of God, but they also have elements that can benefit from the redemption that is to be found in the gospel.
What less diplomatic Christians say is that they think ancestor worship is ungodly, and they reject making it part of modern Jamaican culture. But that's not how the government of Jamaica sees it.
I was exposed to it because I grew up in West Kingston, where I was exposed to Kumina, to Pentecostal.
Jamaica's Minister of Culture is Olivia Babsey Grange. She's in charge of promoting the island's heritage.
It is important for us to continue to protect and promote these African retentions because our young people must understand their roots and what make them the person they are. I'm richer for it, and I want to ensure that I can pass it on.
So the government sponsors Kumina competitions and performances. It's even begun teaching the dancing in schools. At the University of the West Indies, theatre students are running lines, rehearsing a play. Just up the hall is one of the island's leading experts in African traditions, Dr. Marjorie Wiley.
Nick Davis, how are you doing?
Pretty good.
Dr. Wiley is an ethnomusicologist.
There are people in Jamaica who will completely turn away from Kumina. Still others accept it as a very serious part of the culture. Some people will simply look at it as entertainment. There are others who will go deeper into an understanding of it. And then from that understanding comes a complete existence. You may not be a participant, a believer, but you appreciate what is there.
I'm at a wake, or setup as they're called here in Montego Bay, for Miss Gwen. Gwen Reed was 83 years old and lived much of her life in the US, but she wants to be buried back here in Jamaica. People are having a good time. There's lots of drinking and eating going on as family members from near and far have gathered. And the soundtrack to this celebration of her life is Kumina. Gwen's niece Audrey flew in for the funeral. She says that despite some people's concerns over Kumina, more and more see it as a tradition that can't be allowed to die out.
In Jamaica, it's growing as we become more conscious. As we travel, we meet other people from other cultures and we research it and we see that it's something that maybe when we came here we never appreciated it, but now we do.
Ha ha ha!
A member of the Kumina band plays with the audience at the wake, using his voice to mimic the sounds of the modern Jamaican club scene. Whether Jamaicans realise it or not, their beloved reggae music has its roots in Kumina's traditional beats. And Jamaica's dancehall DJs have begun borrowing from Kumina again to breathe new life into the reggae sound.
Hey, why? Hey, make me cry sign from you, no bad mind. Show the God sign from you, no bad mind. Make me cry sign from you, no bad mind. From your clean come join the God line. How we bring the fun back in the dance hall.
In the end, this could be what really popularises Kumina and ensures its survival on this island. For Dispatches, this is Nick Davis in Kingston, Jamaica.
And I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada, reminding you Dispatches is also available on iPhone and iPod Touch. Go to cbcnews.ca, where you can download the free CBC News app. Next week on the program, a rare glimpse of how China behaves in Africa. The People's Republic is a superheated economy with an insatiable appetite for raw materials, and Zambia's copper belt is one of the largest in the world. The CBC's China correspondent, Anthony Germain, went there to find out how China's influence is affecting Zambia. And in this excerpt, you can hear it too.
In the capital city of Lusaka, Zambian workers, business people, electricians, and office clerks are learning the phrase "Wo ai Zambia," I love Zambia, at a recently opened international Chinese school. And Janice Chimanse, a local tax collector who is learning Mandarin, says unlike colonial invaders of the past, at least the Chinese were invited. And learning the new language of a powerful foreign country that's moving in here is something Africans have done for centuries.
I think Chinese is the language of the future. You just have to learn it. Yeah, if you're going to trade more, integrate more, I think you need it.
No strings attached. A story of China's influence in Africa next week on Dispatches. That's our podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. You can download it every Thursday from the web, where we also keep all our past programs, cbc.ca/dispatches. You can also hear us on the National Radio Network of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. We're on Radio 1 Thursday at 1 p.m., with an encore Sunday evening at 7 p.m. in most time zones. This program is the work of producers Donna Dingwall, Allison Baseman, and Steve McNally, with technical producers Victor Johnston and Tim Lorimer, senior producer Alan Gattell, and myself. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. You have just heard Dispatches. We'll bring you the world.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.